The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue is the one that we read from last week as well. It's dated July 6 through July 13. It features a depiction of the profile of the head of a young African-American woman. It's by C. Palmer. The woman is embellished with red roses around her collar and white stars, and in her hair there are floral graffiti elements. Her lips are bright pink. And the first article today is from The View Essays, entitled Food, Honoring the Stories of American Cuisines by Padma Lakshmi. Over 20 years in the food world, I have watched talented chefs and leading restaurants across the U.S. build a new American cuisine. These chefs, typically white and U.S.-born, often treated ingredients like yuzu, turmeric, berber, poblanos, and za'atar as experimental inputs, not parts of other people's history. As an Indian immigrant, I realized there was more to the stories of these foods. To hear these stories, I spent the past year traveling across the U.S., talking with immigrant, Black, and Native American home cooks, chefs, food historians, and restaurateurs. In El Paso, Texas, I met Crystal and Emiliano Marentes, a couple from Mexican immigrant families who had recently opened their own restaurant, Elemi, E-L-E-M-I. Recalling the tortillas their mothers used to cross the border to buy in Juarez, Mexico, they decided to make corn tortillas by hand, a millennia-old process. Emiliano showed me how to make the best taco I've ever tasted, with confited mushrooms, salty quesillo cheese, and beans cooked with Hoya Santa, avocado leaves, and epazote. Stories, it turns out, add flavor. But flavor is not the most important part of this story. It is hard for me to think people are going to accept my tortillas before they accept my cousins, Emiliano told me. His cousins are Mexican citizens on the other side of the border, now so heavily militarized that his family rarely visits. In investigating food, I started learning about shameful periods of U.S. history that we have yet to reckon with. In Phoenix, I met Andy, A-N-D-I, Murphy, a Navajo journalist who hosts Toasted Sister, a podcast on indigenous food. She told me about fried bread, fried dough, sometimes sprinkled with sugar. It dates from the 1860s, when the government forced more than 10,000 Navajo people into a detention camp in New Mexico. Thousands died. To avert mass starvation, officials distributed flour, sugar, and lard, which people cooked into bread. When Chef B.J. Dennis was growing up in South Carolina, his grandfather told stories of planting rice in the yard. They would pound the rice Saturday for Sunday dinner. They were Gullah Geechee, culturally distinct, coastal African Americans. Their ancestors were enslaved people from West Africa's rice-growing regions, whom white slave owners prized for their knowledge of rice paddies. Dennis introduced me to food that contained a history I had never encountered, one of perhaps a half-dozen regional African-American cuisines. For Dennis, a whole value system was wrapped into these foods. He said, being self-sustaining and taking care of family, and his grandfather entrusted him with carrying this on. He said, one day you're going to have to survive the old ways. For me, too. Growing up in New York City, food represented the old ways, our life in India, and the people we left behind. Each summer when I visited my relatives, they would pack a suitcase for me filled with oily pickles, white turmeric, sambar powder, dried green mango, and dried lotus root. How can American chefs talk about turmeric without knowing about the Indians like my mother who brought it here. Without understanding its role in Hindu rites, its centrality as an anti-inflammatory in ancient Ayurvedic medicine, and its part in the spice trade that propelled Europeans to the Americas. I'm not saying you can't sprinkle turmeric into soup without paying tribute to my mom. I'm saying professional chefs, food writers and recipe creators, the taste makers of the food world, should stop cherry-picking what they want from a culture. They should start seeking out and listening to the real cultural experts. Lakshmi is the creator and host of Taste the Nation, a new series on Hulu. From Society, Rethink How We Celebrate Power, by Thomas J. Price. A few days after protesters pulled down a statue of British slave trader Edward Colston in Bristol, England, a statue of the Jamaican-born actor Alfred Fagan in the same city was vandalized with bleach. It was not a coincidence. A lot of feelings are attached to what these individuals represent. Pulling down Colston's statue is not removing history. It is creating a historical moment. You cannot hide behind words like tradition and history if they are used to neutralize any kind of discussion about change. Around the world, statues have been used to exemplify what power looks like and to maintain systems of power. Now the public's looking at its representations of people and delving into uncomfortable parts of history. The response to the removal of Colston's statue has been to ask, whom do we put there instead? There is currently a petition to instate a statue of a black person. We could find alternative figures from history, but that's still playing the game of aggrandizing particular individuals. We should not rush the process of thinking about who gets to make these replacements. White artists are putting themselves forward with no awareness of the irony to create sculptures that replace ones of slave owners. That's a savior complex. There's a sense of entitlement among white creators to think they have the solution. The solution must involve the black experience. Black artists should be looked at first to replace many of these sculptures that may be removed. We have to see the irony in taking down a statue of a slave owner and replacing it with work by an artist whose ancestors benefited from slavery. If we want to use sculptures in public spaces to really engage with history, then there needs to be consultation with the public on a case-by-case basis. We need to get a sense of what people feel. But people are only going to have opinions about what they know. And so things cannot end at sculpture. Education in Britain needs to be looked at from the ground up to teach what Britain was built on, what Britain has done, and what it represents. Without that understanding, we cannot move forward. As a sculptor, I've always been interested in observing other people and trying to create empathy. My initial intention was not to create works about race, but I realized that there's power in the figurative, and there is power in representing people who look like me. I can give a real insight to that experience. Portraiture is based on this idea of people having the money to commission an artwork, or having done such great things that an artwork is commissioned in their honor. All the figures I make are fictional, because I'm trying to critique the whole concept of portraiture. My characters do not smile, because that is a demand placed upon people like myself in order to not seem threatening. I want to remove that weight and that psychological pressure and show that if you are a black person being represented in sculpture, you do not have to be an athlete or strike a pose or fulfill an expectation. These figures do not conform to the expectations of dressing for success. They could be slouching, or they could be wearing a hoodie, as in one of my pieces in reference to police shootings. What you wear as a black man can get you killed. As a black man, you get used to being looked at with suspicion. As well as celebrating our historical figures, I want future sculptures to look like people I recognize. To counter the stream of limiting tropes and identities for black people, not just in the UK, but in the US and globally as well. There needs to be an openness and more nuanced understanding of what it means to be black, and that is going to happen only when there are people in positions of power to commission who understand where our art comes from. We need courage and a genuine desire to learn from and look into our past. We have an opportunity to create a more cohesive society if we choose to take it. Do we further ingrain the current system of choosing historical figures to represent the values we should aspire to? Or do we embrace representations of those who have previously been stigmatized or invisible? It is not going to be popular at the beginning, but as a society, we must make that contract with one another to pursue something more radical. Otherwise, the debate around statues is all just talk. And this is as told to Sue Yan Haynes. Price, the author, is a multidisciplinary artist based in London. From the view, this is in captioned military. The police need to learn about soft power by James Stravitis. Stravitis was 16th Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. His latest book is Sailing, True North. Amid all the long-needed national debate following the murder of George Floyd, one element is emerging as particularly polarizing, the discussion over defunding the police. The phrase has come to meet a wide variety of possible actions, from shutting down entire police departments to shifting some level of funding from police to social services. It is a discussion that is long overdue and wrapped up in highly disparate viewpoints of policing in the country. The Department of Defense's experience internationally can offer some insights to this debate. For much of my career as a senior military officer, I was an advocate for what the military calls soft power. This is the application of Department of Defense resources for international activities other than combat operations, which we call hard power. This came into focus for me during my time as commander of U.S. Southern Command, in charge of all military operations south of the U.S., in Central America, the Caribbean, and South America. From the moment I took command, I did all I could to channel our vast military resources toward the conduct of soft power. In practical terms, this meant reducing the dollars spent on preparations, military exercises, military equipment, live fire training, and the like, and increasing our spending on things like humanitarian operations, building schools, clinics, housing infrastructure, medical diplomacy, providing hospital ships and deploying flying medical clinics, drug education, and training in the rule of law. All of this paid strong benefits. The governments of the region applauded this enhanced soft power version of U.S. military operations, and it became easier to compete with those on the far left, like Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Evo Morales of Bolivia, who would often point to our militarized approach in the region. Of course, we continued to maintain our hard power capability, and our work in Colombia against terrorists and in counter-narcotics required us to do so. But in counter-narcotics, for instance, we've learned that hard power has been a failure in the so-called war on drugs. Far more effective have been education, alternative opportunities for employment, and social support networks. In the context of defunding the police, the first lesson of the military experience is, it depends on the region. We could afford to change our priorities in Latin America, where the probability of hard combat was low. As we think about how to shift resources from hard policing to the soft power side, it should be a very local discussion. This will be challenging as we sort out where police are necessary, against entrenched gangs, say, or violent sex trafficking rings. But there are plenty of examples today in policing where hard power approaches are failing, and the long-term damage to communities is evident. Second, and this is good news, soft power is much less expensive. The training and preparation of hard policing will be much more expensive than the soft power of trained counselors, social programs, counter-drug education, and after-school employment opportunities. We have found that in the military. Third, when given the opportunity to participate in soft power operations, the vast majority of military personnel find it deeply rewarding. After I left Latin America, I became the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, leading the NATO mission in Afghanistan with around 150,000 troops. I discovered even there the soft power tools of clinics, education for girls, agricultural improvements, road building, and counter-narcotics were more effective and probably the most lasting thing we did in the country. For our police departments, I believe the vast majority of officers would be willing participants in soft power operations in their own municipalities. These could run the gamut of partnering with social workers and response teams for domestic violence, helping conduct clinics on fitness and sports, participating in educational events alongside teachers in our schools, volunteering in mentoring programs, and working paid hours supporting homeless shelters and food kitchens. Some cities do this with great success, but too often there's a sharp divide between the hard and soft power sides of the equation. Incorporating the police into the solution would be powerful. No analogy is ever perfect, but soft power is really about shifting toward a policing strategy across this country that understands the need for police to stop murders, but also sees that helping out a community might be the best way to do that. There's a small inset photo here in color, a mountain range in the background, high blue skies with a few white cumulus clouds and a helicopter hovering in that sky. There's also a helicopter on the ground and cueing back from the helicopter into the foreground where the camera lens is are soldiers dressed in what I call fatigues, or maybe they're called camouflage. Most of them are lugging big boxes of something. They're cartons, as you would find from a case of canned corn or something like that. The caption reads, U.S. soldiers load aid onto a helicopter in January 2010 in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, after a devastating earthquake. Under Nation, this is an essay, What Now, America, by Damon Young. Young is the author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. I was off that day because the company I work for made it a holiday, because it happens to be the day, 155 years ago, that Union Army General Gordon Granger declared that all enslaved black people in Texas were now free, too. Since then, Juneteenth has shifted from a day black Texans spent barbecuing and storytelling to a day that some black Americans celebrate, some of us acknowledge, some of us don't even know exists. The latter is a damning indictment of the American educational system. If the schools I attended were my only resource for learning about slavery, I would have thought Abraham Lincoln personally went block to block like an Amazon truck to deliver freedom, and I went to good schools. But in 2020, Juneteenth became another way for America to signal it's finally really, really, really serious about this racism thing. Brands released statements. Businesses declared holidays. Taylor Swift retweeted the route. Some of my friends even shared that they received random funds through Venmo and Cash App from white people they happened to know. And then at 2:52 p.m. ET, the Americanization of this complex and emotional day reached a peak. This is when Snapchat, through its official Twitter account, tweeted an apology for the Juneteenth lens, a filter where it asked users to smile to break a chain superimposed behind the user's head. At this rate, by the time you read this, Juneteenth might have already grown sentient and replaced Joe Biden as the presumptive Democratic nominee for president. I do not know what's happening in America right now. The velocity of the collective national willingness to acknowledge anti-black racism has been unsettling, eerie. What feeling other than a deep and paralyzing disorientation are we supposed to possess when NASCAR, decides to ban the Confederate flag from its stadiums? My first thought when hearing about that, well, I guess there must be two NASCARs. But while the what remains cloudy, the why this is happening right now, is more clear. I still have not watched the footage of George Floyd's last 9 minutes on earth. The widely disseminated screen grab of Derek Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck, like how maybe you'd kneel on the pavement to get a better camera angle for a portrait photo, was enough for me. And the way he died, not just that he was killed, but how, matters. As brutal and witnessing a video captured shooting can be, the bang, bang, bang happened so quickly that processing exactly what you just saw takes some time. This was different. Depraved indifference is one of those terms that might be used in a courtroom to describe what happened there. But what Derek Chauvin did transcends legal jargon. It was just depraved. Evil. If this had happened in 2019 or even January of this year, I'm certain there would have been national protests. But what is different now? What's changed each of our lives forever? Why people around the world are in the streets is COVID-19. We're currently in a global pandemic that's killed more than 100,000 Americans, and our death rates do not appear to be dropping as much as other countries have. And the abject mismanagement of our national response to this virus is largely due to white supremacy. White supremacy is why a destructive, petty, ignorant, criminally unfit man is our president. White supremacy is how a belief in science has somehow become a partisan issue. Lunacy-inducing white supremacy accounts for the absurd theater of American men and women threatening and terrifying baristas while angrily refusing to don masks because of some nebulous concept of freedom. What COVID's devastation and the bizarre response to it in some pockets of America has done is make the tracks and tentacles of white supremacy less concealable and spinnable and more plain. We are essentially in the midst of two pandemics, and it seems as if white people are seeing finally that white supremacy kills them too. We humans are incentive-based beings, and there is no greater incentive than remaining alive. Unfortunately for them, for us, for everyone, there's no easy solution here, no microwavable absolution, no quick fix for a foundational rot. Removing Confederate monuments is a noble gesture, I guess, but what about the slave owners whose faces are on our money? How do we reckon with that? A company's statement of support for Black Lives Matter is cool. But what about the decades of discrimination and pay inequities at that same company? The random cash white people are Venmoing to us is awesome. I have not received any myself, though my fingers are still crossed. But how do you begin to remedy the wealth gap where black families have 10 cents for every dollar possessed by white families? There's no industry, no institution, no person in America unaffected by anti-blackness, and no hashtag to retweet or holiday to finally acknowledge to make it better. That said, cynical as I want to be, as I need to be to protect myself, what is happening now is a start, but it is just that, a start. Whether America has the will and the rigor and the stamina to see this through is yet to be seen, and I will not hold my breath waiting for it, but I did enjoy Juneteenth off, did some work around the house, went for a nice walk, so thanks for that, at least. This is a continuation of the article under Nation and Policy, 12 Ways Trump Has Deepened Inequality. I will read excerpts from this by Abby Vesoulis, Weakening Shields for Payday Loan Recipients. When Candace Russell needed an unexpected medical procedure in 2014, she had no way to pay for it. She had recently separated from her husband, and her wages as a Texas bartender were not cutting it, so she borrowed $450 from a payday lender. After a year and a half and two subsequent payday loans she had hoped would finally get her out of the red, she realized she was $10,000 in the hole. Every time I got to a point where I thought I'd gotten myself out of it, something would inevitably happen, says Russell, now 37. It is a common experience for low-income Americans, a vicious cycle of using one payday loan to service another. Up to 12 million Americans take out payday loans each year, according to a 2016 fact sheet by Pew Charitable Trusts. The averages describe a borrower who's in debt for 5 months out of the year and spends $520 on fees to take out the same $375 loan over and over. Black Americans are especially vulnerable because they're less likely to have stable credit. They are 105% more likely than other Americans to seek these loans, according to Pew. The Obama-era Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, issued a rule to protect these borrowers, requiring payday lenders to ensure people could repay loans before issuing advances. I don't think it's brain surgery to say if somebody's in trouble and then you give them a loan and charge them a 390% interest rate, they will end up trapped in debt, says former CFPB Director Richard Cordray. But the Trump administration, backed by the loan industry, is trying to repeal the rule, arguing that payday lenders help Americans who need access to emergency cash. Cordray says the repeal will have the opposite effect. This is one of the most glaring examples of how this administration's focus has been on protecting financial companies at the expense of consumers. Blocking trans troops from the military. With a trio of tweets in 2017, Trump declared he was rolling back an Obama-era policy that permitted transgender Americans to openly serve in the military. The armed forces cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption, Trump wrote. But implementing the new policy turned out to be more complicated than posting it on social media. What ensued was a series of court orders that barred the change. The administration pushed forward anyway and was granted approval from the Supreme Court to proceed on an interim basis. Now, anyone who has medically transitioned or is currently transitioning is disqualified from enlisting. Individuals who are currently serving in the military but were diagnosed with gender dysphoria after April 2019 must serve in the sex they were assigned at birth, seek out a series of complex waivers, or leave. The policy exempts existing service members who transitioned before the rule went into effect. House Democrats have challenged the rule, as has public opinion. 71% of adults now support the right of openly transgender people to serve, according to Gallup. Obstructing access to abortion. While the U.S. awaits a Supreme Court decision expected this summer that will determine whether it was legal for Louisiana to impose severe restrictions on abortion providers, social conservatives already have something to celebrate. In February, a U.S. appeals court ruled in favor of a new Trump administration regulation that forbids family planning centers that receive federal funding to refer pregnant women for abortions. The funding program, called Title X, or Title X, I think it's Title X, provides patients with affordable access to birth control, HIV tests, and cancer screenings. As a result of the policy change, scores of clinics have left Title X in protest. Critics argue the new rule imposes bureaucratic hurdles on patients who rely on the program, 22% of whom are Black and 33% of whom are Hispanic or Latino. Your access to reproductive health care depends on your zip code, depends on your income, and depends on a host of factors beyond your control, says Gretchen Borchelt of the National Women's Law Center. The Trump administration's attacks are just making that worse. Reducing Native Americans' land. Since taking office, Trump has consistently sided with the oil and gas industry over environmental and Native American interests. In December 2017, he backed local Republican officials and cut the size of a Utah land monument by 85% to cultivate it for recreation. Multiple indigenous tribes claim roots to the land. The same year, the president issued an executive order revoking a tribal advisory council's power in decisions impacting part of the Bering Sea. The message, says Natalie Landreth of the Native American Rights Fund, is that Native American priorities were not important. And finally, from this gathering of articles, deterring travelers from predominantly Muslim countries. Judges blocked Trump's first two efforts to enact broad travel restrictions on countries with large Muslim populations, ruling the president's moves likely violated federal immigration statutes. But in June 2018, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Trump's third attempt, allowing him to impose travel restrictions on individuals from seven countries, five of which have Muslim majorities. Since then, the U.S. State Department has all but stopped issuing visas to people from Libya, Iran, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. The ban also applies to North Koreans, who are mostly unable to travel to the U.S., and a handful of Venezuelan officials and their families. The Trump administration says the travel restrictions were necessary to secure America's borders. But critics say the move was designed to paint Muslims as uniquely threatening in a country where right-wing terrorists have been responsible for more deaths since the 9/11 attacks than jihadists. The new restrictions also affect the communal aspect of the Islamic faith, says Robert McCaw of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. There are many intergenerational households that are disrupted when children cannot connect with grandparents, aunts, and uncles, he said. And that is an attack on the family structure of Muslims in America. Under the heading World, from the hotel terrace where he ate breakfast, Phil Peltzer could almost pretend nothing had changed. Yes, the maitre d' had aimed a temperature gun at his head before allowing him near the buffet, and he would not usually serve himself eggs in gloves and a mask. But the friendly waitresses still addressed him in halting German, and the sun still warmed his pale, tattoo-covered arms. For Peltzer, a plumber from Alsdorf, Germany, who has long taken his annual vacation on the Spanish island of Majorca, the important things were still in place. There is still sun, there is still sand, he said. Maybe it's not quite so much fun as before, but it's still a holiday. On that wan enthusiasm rests a continent's hopes. Peltzer and his family were among the 400 or so German tourists who traveled June 15 to Majorca as part of a pilot program run in collaboration between the tour company TUI and the Balearic Islands regional government. It was originally conceived as a way for both the vacation hotspot and the tour company to test their preparedness to once again receive visitors after months of lockdown. But even before the Peltzers boarded the plane in Dusseldorf, Spain decided it could not afford to wait to learn the results. On June 21, spurred by both economic necessity and its neighbors' rush to open, the Spanish government formally ended its state of emergency and opened its borders again to European tourists. As much of Europe abandoned its mandatory quarantines and followed suit, the pilot program was watched across the continent with acute interest and no little anxiety. TUI had sold out the two flights in a matter of hours, but would that level of interest be sustained? Would it be enough to offset the loss of American and Asian tourists whose return might still be months away? Would it be safe for both the visitors and the locals who received them? And would making them safe with all the personal protective equipment and social distancing required turn a relaxing break into something more closely akin to a hospital stay? As Europe begins its recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, countries are attempting to find a middle ground between protecting public health from a virus that still poses a threat and reviving moribund economies. Perhaps no sector faces higher stakes than tourism. It was, after all, travel that supercharged the pandemic, allowing a virus to move from the markets of Wuhan, China, to the ski resorts of Italy, the conference halls of Germany, the ports of Japan and California. And in the absence of a vaccine, it is clear that tourism's necessary components, not just airplanes and cruise ships, but also hotels, restaurants, museums, festivals, remain important vectors for the virus's potential transmission. Yet in Europe especially, tourism is also critical to the economy. In the 27 nations that make up the European Union, up to 11% of the collected GDP derives directly from tourism, compared with 2.6% in the U.S. In Paris alone, tourism represents the single largest industry, bigger even than services or fashion, and the 38 million who visit the city annually keep nearly 12% of all working Parisians employed. It has been a cliff, vertigineux, says Paris Deputy Mayor Jean-François Martin, of the drop-off brought about by the lockdowns. There will be millions and millions of Paris visitors missing from the beginning of the crisis until we get back to normal. The pain stretches up and down the food chain, from stalwart airlines like Lufthansa and SAS that are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy to small companies like Athens Insiders, which organizes everything from afternoon tastings at Athens markets to week-long archaeological tours. When Greece locked down in mid-March, we had 100% cancellations, said Anthea Velasopoulou, the CEO and co-owner of the 18-person company. Because it caters primarily to American tourists, she does not expect any of them back until 2021. We predict revenues will be down 90% for the year, Velasopoulou says. Our only hope is persuading our clients to postpone their trips rather than canceling them so that we do not have to refund their deposits. Government bailouts and unemployment subsidies have kept many, though by no means all, enterprises on life support during these past few months, but as countries pull back assistance, the projections are dire. According to the World Travel and Tourism Council, Europe's on track to lose 18.4 million tourism-related jobs and $1 trillion in GDP in 2020. It might seem trivial in the context of a global health emergency, but finding ways for Europeans like Phil Peltzer and his family to safely enjoy a summer vacation could provide a lifeline to millions of people. It could also be crucial to Europe's future. Just like the debt crisis of a decade ago, the coronavirus poses a threat to an already fragile European unity. The economic and political bloc relies on multilateral cooperation. Often borders and free open borders and free movement of people, all of which were tossed out the window during the worst of the crisis. As they cautiously reopen, each European country is taking its own approach to border controls and health protocols. But rebuilding a tourist economy is something they must do together. If they succeed, European unity might just come out stronger. As the coronavirus began to proliferate outside China, Europe was among the first places to feel its full impact. Although the first cases were detected in France, Italy quickly became an epicenter and the first European country to impose a draconian lockdown. There, and in a few other countries like Spain, France, and the UK, infection and mortality rates spiraled almost out of control. Other countries like Germany have had relatively high infection rates, but managed to avoid the devastating rate of mortality through a combination of extensive testing and quick action. And then there are a handful of places like Denmark and Greece that, through a still mysterious combination of good policy and good luck, have managed to avoid the full brunt of the disease. The majority of countries in Europe are now well past the peak of their outbreaks. During the spring, when it became clear the summer season would be limited at best, many began investigating the creation of so-called corridors of bubbles that would allow citizens of areas that appeared to have the virus under control to travel safely. The idea is to create green zones that would first unite geographic areas where the virus was under control and economic activity could be restored, says Bari Prodelsky, an economist at France's National Center for Scientific Research. He and colleague Miguel Oliobartan wrote an article on the European policy think tank site Vox EU in late April that would prove influential in how both France and Spain approach their reopenings. The plan, he says, would be to bridge those zones with others in a similar situation. The Baltic states, for example, united in mid-May to allow citizens of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia to visit one another's countries unimpeded. More recently, Denmark opened its doors to Germans, Norwegians, and Icelanders, though not its neighbors in Sweden, which has substantially higher infection and mortality rates. The EU's leadership endorsed the approach, noting in a report on May 13 that handled correctly, safely, and in a coordinated manner, the months to come could offer Europeans the chance to get some well-needed rest, relaxation, and fresh air, and to catch up with friends and family in their own member states or across borders. But as Prodelsky points out, that coordination has not been entirely forthcoming. The earliest zoning just conformed to national borders, which had nothing to do with the realities of the virus, he says. Now we're seeing bilateral agreements, but we hope they're just the starting point. He hopes the EU's executive body will set union-wide benchmarks for testing and border controls. Unless we find common standards, people are not going to feel safe. Then there will not be enough demand for tourism. But these will always be guidelines. Ultimately, individual member states call the shots over their own borders. As a result, the current situation is a sometimes bewildering patchwork of exemptions. Austria, for example, has chosen to bar visitors from Spain, Portugal, Sweden, and the UK. Greece requires a test for the virus from anyone arriving from Italy, Spain, Netherlands, Sweden, among others. Even Denmark, which June 18 announced it was opening its borders, continues to bar entrance from Sweden, one of the few countries in Europe still seeing new case numbers rise. All member states are currently haggling over which non-EU countries sufficiently meet health and other criteria to be permitted in July and beyond, and it does not look good for the U.S. The dire economic situation does not necessarily encourage member states to cooperate and may in fact be fostering a sense of competition. Being first out of the gate was certainly part of the calculation for Mallorca's pilot program. We wanted to verify the protocols we had put into place, says Iago Negreira, Minister of Tourism for the Balearic Islands Regional Government, because we knew that as islands coming out of this in the summer, we would be popular with tourists. But we also wanted to do it because it allows us to position ourselves with regard to Europe as a safe destination. The fact of being first has its own potential. In some ways, Mallorca, the largest of the Balearics, is the perfect microcosm for a Europe attempting to recover from the pandemic. A relatively early and near total shutdown allowed the chain of Balearic Islands in which it sits to avoid the kind of carnage experienced in Madrid and Barcelona. But the island's outsized reliance on tourism, 34.8% of the GDP, makes it highly vulnerable to whatever comes next. And because neither Americans nor Asian tourists travel to Mallorca in great numbers, Germany and UK are its biggest markets, it offers a clear reflection of how the rest of the continent might welcome visitors from a range of nearby countries. It matters that we were first to do this, Negreira said after the first flights landed. We were on the news in every country last night, and we are seeing it to have a bandwagon effect, with more flights being announced and more hotels opening. There's a kind of competition with other regions and countries, so it is good to be out there first. For his part, Phil Peltzer felt safe. The hotel seems to be taking a lot of precautions, and we've been wearing masks back in Germany, so that did not bother me, he said, as he and his family headed off to pick up their rental car for a day they planned to spend touring the island's interior. In many ways, he represents the kind of tourist Europe is banking its hopes on, family-oriented, more interested in sightseeing and lounging on the beach than in getting wasted, and above all, willing to spread some cash around. I don't know if I'd say it's my dream vacation, he said, but we're still having fun. And that article was slightly abridged. Time off, open air. With television, the heading, TV Scrambles to Keep Up with Social Change by Judy Berman. In early June, all 19 Discovery Network's channels aired the two-part special, OWN, O-W-N, Spotlight. Where do we go from here? The programs, which drew nearly 11 million viewers, plus 6.7 million on YouTube, consisted solely of an extensive, socially distant conversation between Oprah Winfrey and a panel of black politicians, artists, activists, and public intellectuals about the reinvigorated Black Lives Matter movement, culminating with the participants outlining their asks. Stacey Abrams stressed the need for fair elections. The Reverend William J. Barber II, leader of the Poor People's Campaign, called for an end to poverty. On a somewhat different note, Color of Change Executive Director Rashad Robinson wanted to see crime TV shows stop ignoring systemic racism. You see tons of black and brown characters, Robinson observed, but it's a world where black and brown people exist, but racism seems not to exist. This, he said, fuels demands for fixing black people and black families instead of fixing the systems that harm and hurt us. Robinson's organization has proved prescient on the issue of race and policing on TV. When Fox canceled the long-running reality series Cops in 2013, it was amid pressure from Color of Change. Revived on Spike TV and then Paramount Network, which canceled it again June 9, the show is now probably gone for good. A&D nixed its similar but more popular and perhaps also crueler Live PD the next day. Years into the Black Lives Matter movement and decades after the Civil Rights Movement began, the work today's activists are continuing. The pace of progress is accelerating. In the political realm, the result has been the repeal of a New York law shielding police disciplinary records. A city council vote in Minneapolis to disband the police department responsible for George Floyd's death, and mainstream voices calling for radical changes in policing. Other sectors of public life, and the entertainment world in particular, are, amid a pandemic that's already paralyzed so many industries, scrambling to keep up. For TV, that has meant highlighting and opening access to existing titles that take on issues of racial justice, as well as filling COVID-related holes in schedules with specials like Oprah's. It's also meant reevaluating current programs from Law and Order to Paw Patrol, purging casts and crews of apparent racists, and for streaming services with film libraries that span more than a century, auditing archives for offensive materials. Not all of these choices are as urgent as the decision to end reality shows that glorify cops and exploit black suffering, but the messiness does not make this reckoning any less crucial for an industry that shapes how Americans see ourselves and one another. This was also an excerpted article. Time off, a book review. Seeing Japan's Invisible Citizens by Suyin Haynes. To be homeless is to be ignored when people walk past while still being in full view of everyone, says Kazu, the elderly protagonist of Yu Miri, that's Y-U space M-I-R-I's, Tokyo Ueno Station. A migrant worker, Kazu exists on the fringes of society, staying with other homeless people in Ueno Park, near the city's busy, claustrophobic railway station. In this liminal space among the ghosts of other wandering men and women, watching the seasons roll from one end to the next, Kazu mourns the life he used to know and the people he used to love. Born in Japan to Korean parents, Yu is skilled at centering the outsider's perspective in her writing. As a radio host, she helped tell the stories of those affected by the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in Fukushima. Her empathy extends to this novel, first published in Japan last year. Yu's poetic, lyrical style invites readers to grieve Kazu's losses, even as he is unable to do so. The themes of exile and conflicting identities in Tokyo Ueno Station are hallmarks of post-war Zionichi literature, a genre rooted in the experience of ethnic Koreans in Japan. As key moments in Kazu's life intersect with that of the Emperor Akihito, Yu creates a series of vignettes of one man's small life against the broader backdrop of Japanese history. In so doing, she shows what it's like to live perpetually on the periphery. Kevin Kwan is the author of Crazy Rich Asians, and he speaks here of economic inequality, his new book, and embracing his identity. The column is written by Lucy Feldman. There is a photo here of Kevin Kwan, a young man wearing white slacks, a dark-colored blazer, a dark and white striped, horizontally striped shirt, not tucked in. He has shoulder-length black hair. He's wearing dark-rimmed glasses, and he is smiling at the camera. Question, how have you coped with the pandemic? Answer, I am just trying to imagine, well, this is what it was like during the war for my grandparents, except that we are not facing bombings or Japanese troops knocking on your door wanting to take you away. We just have to be disciplined and cooperative for the sake of the greater community, and that's new for so many of us in this country. What are you thinking about? more political engagement. We are in a crisis moment for democracy. We need to look at the power structures we've put in place. Are we, the people, really being served? The U.S. is reckoning with systemic racism against black people. How should Asian Americans respond to this moment? I have really been trying to be meaningful in my engagement. I joined hashtag Blackout Tuesday, but there were all these comments from Asians saying, why didn't you post when an elderly Chinese woman was attacked on the subway? Or why aren't you helping Hong Kong? We're in a state of siege too. We are at a point in the world where there is so much pain. I am looking for ways to effectively be of help, whether by speaking up, lending my name, donating money, or trying to continue to push myself to make work that helps to amplify and enlighten and bring healing and joy. As fun as your books are, they also decry massive wealth. How do you approach those themes? It begins at the core with economic inequality. The gulf between the crazy rich and everyone else is just so, so vast. And that is at the root of every problem. I don't try to hit people over the head, but I tell stories that hopefully make them think. In a strange way, you can tell a lot more truth with satire. What made you want to look at the U.S. for your new novel, Sex and Vanity? My lens turns toward New York and the class structures and privilege that exist in this country and the institutions that serve to keep people out. There's snobbery between the old money and the new tech money, between the old Chinese and the new Chinese. I also really wanted to look at a character like Lucy, who is biracial. I was excited to read about a HAPA character like me. What drew you to that identity? It wasn't being represented in modern contemporary fiction. I have so many HAPA, HAPA, cousins, from Asian Americans to Chinese, British to Australian Asians. And that article is now abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.